Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen talk radio show. My guest today is Alex Strauss, author of How Have I Got a Guy for You? The True Stories of Well-Meaning Mismatched Dates Set Up by Moms. As one would say, the good news is you got a date, the bad news is your mom set it up. Alex and I will be discussing her mischievous collection of true stories of mismatched dates set up by mom with good intentions that exacerbate the mother-daughter bond with a flare of humor and a touch of tenderness. And as an added bonus, we will also be discussing her latest novel based upon availability, which just came out last month. Good morning, Alex. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen. How are you feeling this morning?
Everything is good here in New York, and it's a delight to be on your show.
I'm glad to have you on the show. It's enjoyed reading your book. It's very funny. I could relate to some of the stories, and we'll go into that a little bit later. But for a start, let us talk about you. Please tell us a little bit about yourself from childhood to the present moment. Give us a wonderful little snapshot of your life.
Okay. Well, I grew up on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. I'm a total city kid, born and raised. And I love New York. I really do love everything about it. And, you know, I didn't really think I would be a writer. I sort of fell into it. I had high hopes for acting, and I was one of those kids who definitely did commercials and print work and things like that starting at the age of 12. And by my early 20s, there weren't really great, there were no great shows for women or, you know, this was really a terrific time because it was really make your own. It was, you could start your own theater company, you could, you know, independent films were just getting started. And, you know, I started writing a play really in the hopes of saying, well, you know, if you write it, they have to put you in it. And it was very evident and really quite clear that I was just a better writer than I was an actor. And that's sort of how it all began. So for the past 15 or so years, I've been writing and have thankfully been quite successful at it. This is my fourth, I'm on my fourth book now, and I cover trends on a journalistic side. I cover trends, whether it's celebrities or food or travel or spas and things like that. And I'm a pop culture whore, as I like to call myself, because I just, I love finding out things that are of the moment and things that are iconic and of the past and such. So it's been really lovely to be able to write about all those things and, in essence, to really, you know, love what you do and do what you love.
What inspired you to be a writer?
You know, I guess at the end of the day, I have a lot of stories to tell. I have a lot of characters that have the need to speak. And in terms of on the journalistic side, there's something wonderful about being able to share, you know, how you look at something, or being able to share a new trend or new information, and to write it in a creative way that maybe somebody else hasn't written about it before.
What, did you have any other family members that were writers, such as your parents? Or, you know, I mean, growing up, you're doing a lot of different things.
Not at all, sadly. Yes, I definitely did do a lot of different things. But no, I'm an only child, so I didn't have siblings to, you know, follow in their footsteps. And my father was a stockbroker, and my mother really was a teacher for a year or two, and then really, I guess, you know, wanted to spend time with me and be an at-home mother because her mother was not. And never really went back to teaching or finding something that, you know, my mother would be great at a number of things, and I just don't think she had the impetus to really move forward with that. But she claimed she was very creative. So my mother claims that she did, at one point she did want to be an actress and and such, but she had terrible stage fright, so she quickly dismissed that idea.
What was that one movie that you saw as a child that sort of inspired you to, you know, like, hey, this is something that I want to do?
You know, there weren't any. The joke was I came out of the womb singing. So I think from the get-go, that was it. It was very cut and dry. I was going to be an actor. That was it. I guess that doesn't help the question much, but
no,
there really
no,
there wasn't. I went to college for acting.
Yeah.
And the writing really was a surprise. So my career sort of found me rather than me finding it.
Right. Oh, that's wonderful. I'm just wanting to know how it all began in terms of what got you to lean in a certain way, because I'm sure your mom had exposed you to all the different things, to sort of like a testing of things as you grow up as a child, and then
I'm so sorry to mean to interrupt you.
Yeah,
I was gonna
go
say
ahead.
She didn't. You know, it sounds odd, but you know, I was a very ambitious child, and I knew at a very early age that's what I wanted to do. I didn't, you know, my parents weren't the kind of parents that you have to get A's, you have to, do well in school. I think it was understood, but they really were. I was a very, very hard worker. I understood from a very early age about money and making a living. And, you know, I had a lemonade stand when I was very little. I still love money. I love money. So I think that they saw a very business. It's very interesting because most creative people are not as business savvy or don't run their career in a business way.
Right.
But, you know, I'm a left-handed person, but I think both left-handed and right-handed. So I'm actually quite good in business, and yet the creativity really does dominate so much of what I do. So it's an odd mix. I didn't have parents who said, we really would love for you to look into other options because, you know, and at 12, when you're making money, you're successful. Why say to a child, well, you know, you're already in the Screen Actors Guild and you're in AFTRA and Equity and everything. Have you thought about, you know, becoming a chef? You know, I actually had a very clear path of what I wanted to do.
And how was that with your dad, though? I mean, him being in business as stockbroker, and so I'm sure he's delighted to see that you're able to, I guess, understand and comprehend the world of finance in some ways.
Yeah, he was, he really didn't, I don't think he actually understood what the creativity was all about. He was a very cut and dry, you get up at 7, you're out the door at 7:30, you know, every day was the same for him. He went to an office, he had the same, he was a very well thought of stockbroker, and, you know, he came from a very business-oriented place. There really was not a creative bone in my father's body. And I think, though, what they did get was that I was an extraordinarily responsible child at a very early age, and again, an extremely ambitious child. So I really think that they really let me be. In one sense, I was incredibly driven. My sense is I was unusually driven. So, you know, nobody told me to go out and get a summer job. I got one on my own. And I think that when something's working, you know, parents sort of step back. It's interesting from a city kid point of view, you know, I never came home drunk. I never put anything up my nose. I was a really good, I was a good kid, and I had a very, very sharp understanding for business and how to be successful. And I was very fortunate because I think when I became a writer, you know, I really turned those other resources, or having those resources of being or having a business savvy sensibility into a business, which it's great to be creative, but it's very difficult to just be creative. A lot of, you know, I have a lot of friends that are writers and they're still in their pajamas at 2 in the afternoon.
Right.
You know, that is not the kind of writer that I am.
Right. Right. You're very disciplined. You obviously, you have a certain amount of that concept of what you want to get done, and you got it done in your own way.
I was extremely disciplined, and I think you really need to be in any career that you're making yourself, you know, anything that you're freelancing in, you have to be driven. You have to have passion. You have to be driven. You have to be organized, And, you know, yes, luck definitely helps, having connections, absolutely. But, you know, part of it is the joy of having all the control. And
right.
Nobody's going to, you know, do it for you. No one's going to kick your ass in gear. You have to you have to do it yourself. And if you're going to stay in bed all day, you're
right.
not going to be productive. It's,
right.
You know, those things to me are very cut and dry. If you want it, you have to reach for it. If you want it, you have to push yourself to get it. You know, it's a very difficult, as any is, you know, it's a very difficult
mm-hmm.
business. All businesses are hard. Writing mm-hmm. is a career. It's a business. It has to, and very often it needs to be run like that.
Do you feel, though, as she got into it, that because of the environment being that, you know, wait a minute now, there is a tremendous amount of challenge and pressure from the opposite gender and everything else, that added more fuel to your passion? Or is this something, is just a natural? Had it not been there, you would have been the same way?
I think I'm lucky in the respect that I'm filled with probably too much passion, and I'm
mm-hmm,
probably
mm-hmm.
a little too driven. And I don't think I would have been half as successful had I not had either of those characteristics. Because it's an incredibly difficult business to pursue.
I'm sure it is. I mean, you're a very successful woman, and obviously you got everything done by yourself, which is very, very interesting. It's a tremendous role model, I would say, to anyone out there who is looking for someone that, hey, I can make it. And you certainly exemplify that from the stories that you shared with us in terms of your childhood experience. What gave you the idea of, have I got a guy for you?
I had been on a number of bad dates, mostly coordinated by my mother, unfortunately. And she, the last date she had set me up with, the guy was married. And I, you know, that really takes away the idea that both of you are indeed single. So
right.
I really, that was the breaking point for me. A, it was such an awful date. And B, I couldn't believe anybody would go out on a date if they're married. I mean, it just makes no sense. And I was so livid. After coming home and yelling at my mother for a half an hour, I started calling friends to vent. And one after the other said, oh, that's nothing. Have I got have I got a story?
Mm-hmm.
And then they would tell me their stories. And at the end, by the fourth person, it was very evident that we had a book. I mean, it was just...
Right.
It really, in one sense, I felt like one date really was worse than the next. And my married man didn't hold a candle. You know, at least he took me out for dinner. he picked me up and took me home. There were other girls that were either stranded or forced
right.
to wear costumes or,
right.
you know.
Right.
So the 26 authors that make up Have I Got a Guy for You,
yeah.
you know, are all writers and journalists of some sort. And we're sadly all fixed up by their mothers, and the dates were really horrific in one way or another. And so I was really surprised that nobody had ever done a book like this before. I thought this was pretty pretty standard, you know, and yet there were a couple of dating horror stories that came out in terms of, you know, they were just bad dates gone awry. But nobody had ever focused on the mother-daughter relationship and the need mothers have for setting up their daughters, and which is an epidemic. You know, it doesn't matter black, white, you know, Jewish, not Jewish.
Right.
If you were 20 years old, if you were 40 years old, we found mothers across the board. We're doing, you know, it's that question, are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? That the kids always ask when they're in the car. It's the same. If you have a mother, chances are she try to set you up.
Right. I agree with that. I mean, it had happened to me too. So I could certainly relate to some of the stories that you have in the book. How did you meet the various contributors? Were you friends with all the 26 contributors?
No, not at all. I was friends with maybe one or two of the women who wrote their stories. And then I think that, you know, what's great about the internet, it is such a wonderful resource. And, of course, Facebook wasn't up yet, so it was that good old-fashioned sort of send it out to, you know, 8 friends or 20 friends on email, on good old-fashioned AOL, and you know, ask them to send it to their friends. And it really was through a lot of reaching out, a lot of networking. I reached out to agents. I reached out to editors. I reached out to writer friends. And we had something like 163 submissions that we had to go through. At the end of the day,
Yeah.
A lot of people sent in some queries, and then the goal was that, you know, we wanted every story to be a little bit different, and mm-hmm. we wanted every story to meet three people. We wanted you certainly to meet the mother, the daughter, mm-hmm. and the date. And mm-hmm. at the end of the day, you know, we had to find a way to tell that story within 2,200 words.
Mm-hmm.
So there were
mm-hmm.
there was some structure, and there were some goals that we absolutely had. And we didn't want it to just be, we wanted a beginning and a middle and an end to each story. We didn't want it just to be like, oh, this guy was mean or rude. There mm-hmm. really mm-hmm. needed to be some sort of substance there.
Very interesting. And as you developed this wonderful stories, which one did you find the most hilarious one for you?
Oh, my God, so many of them are funny. I think just in terms of, like, I can't believe this actually happened.
Moment. Right, right.
We had one woman whose mother, for whatever reason, she decided to fix her daughter up with the mailman.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this mailman had probably seen her grow up. I mean, what an odd choice. But
right.
And such a strange thing to do, but she didn't want to go out with the mailman by himself, which I can appreciate. And
mm-hmm.
she had visions of course him showing up in his little male uniform, and I'm sure he's a perfectly lovely guy, but so for whatever reason, I think she had known his sister.
Mm-hmm.
So the mailman, his sister and the sister's date, they all four of them went out together, and at one point the sister made a pass at her in the mm-hmm. bathroom, and the mailman brother mm-hmm. made a pass at her under the table, and by the mm-hmm. time they got into the car to go home, both siblings had their hand on her leg.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and that's just the most bizarre, preposterous. I mean, it's movie magic. You know, you can't
right,
you can't
right.
write something more bizarro and sad and humorous.
Right. Right.
I think the one where the girl is set up by her mother, who it's her mother's dentist, and he shows up in a Dungeons and Dragons costume, and it's
right.
that she wears a costume, and you know, that's just, it was like an 8-hour, you know, off the date is just, it's more than anyone can stand. That's
right.
That's too much pressure.
Right. It's interesting. One of my favorite ones is the I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, is Shadi Ahi Nahi by Anita Kawatra. It's a wonderful story because this is where you start crossing cultures with regards to the length at what length mom would go through to find a suitor for her daughter. Please tell us about that story.
Oh, sure. Anita's a great writer, and it was a very fun story. And she's, you know, her culture is of the Indian descent, and, you know, they are... in that culture, it's totally normal to find your daughter a husband and to try different routes. And, you know, that's still an era where dates can almost, or marriages can almost be prearranged. So the mm-hmm. mother got on a website, an Indian dating website, and found a suitor for her daughter and didn't tell her daughter that she was doing this, and they sat her down and said, listen, you know, we found this guy for you. We went through all these photos, and, you know, here's the date. And my friend Anita was horrified. I mean, really, like, couldn't believe her parents had done this, and she, you know, begrudgingly agreed to go on the date. And the guy was just a mess. He was a journalist from the BBC, and looked great on paper, and the minute they sat down for drinks and appetizers or whatever, he bombarded her with a list of questions like, how do you see your life? How many children do you want? And then he proceeded to say, when I'm on vacation, I want sex every day. And she was like, you know, she's still trying to figure out what drink she wants to order.
Mm-hmm.
So to be bombarded like that, and, you know, it was just such a shock to her. And then,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's also, you don't care where that culture is from in terms of, that's just bad manners.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why would anybody sit down and in the first 20 minutes of knowing someone demand sex every day if you're on vacation? You know, she was still ordering a drink. You know, this is what I don't get. You know, this is the honeymoon period. You know,
right.
you're supposed to put your best foot forward.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you say that to someone? Do people really not know? I mean, come on. He was a sophisticated guy. you know, wrote for the BBC, was educated, you know, clearly lacking common sense. Mm-hmm. Common sense not so common.
Well, the flip side also is that cultures, whether it's, you know, the Indian culture or whatever culture that one comes from, the when a situation like that happened, it is obviously based on family appropriation. You know, you're supposed to get, it's not so much love as it is, you know, it's time for me to settle down and make family, for lack of a better term. So it's quite interesting because he may, even though he may be well educated and everything else, but he's on the website and the mother is on the website and they're looking at strictly from a standpoint of just building a family.
You know what? I'm sorry, Jenny. I got to disagree with you. It's not a business. It's not a business meeting. And you know
what? Oh, I know.
Think,
I agree
I
with
think,
that.
I think that's going to turn anybody off, male or
right.
female,
right.
to sit in the first 20 minutes and say, oh, by the way, you don't know me at all, but I would like to have sex with you or my wife
right,
every morning
right,
on
right.
vacation.
You know, I agree with that. I agree with that. I'm not saying it's right.
Yeah, I just think I don't care, you know, whether he's on the website or not. It's just stupid.
It
shame
is.
Shame on him. And shame on, listen, shame on the guy who wanted to bring his wife to the dinner, you know. Shame on the, you know, shame on a guy for asking a girl to dress up in a Dungeons and Dragons costume. You know, there's just, it astounds me.
Mm-hmm.
And listen, that's not to say we're all, you know, saints either. I'm sure there
right.
are men who have just as many grievances
right.
and bad days with women. You know, mm-hmm. I'm sure we've been late. I'm sure we've been obnoxious. I'm sure we've done a slew of things incorrect. I'm sure we've
right.
gotten drunk at the table. Who knows? Mm-hmm. I'm sure we've ordered lobster when we really just should have had a good girl, you know, fair-priced pick. You know,
right.
I'm sure there is just as much blame on both sides. I'm just saying in terms, I think there's an enormous amount of bad behavior, and I think
mm-hmm.
that it's hard to set people up, and I think it's even harder when it's your mother, who, of course, has the best of intentions. My
mm-hmm.
mother didn't purposely say, let me find Alex the worst guy possible.
Right.
You know, but in her defense, she wants the best for me, and I think my mother's biggest mistake is she hears the word man. She, you know, she didn't even hear single at this point with the married guy. So who she supposedly said she didn't know was married.
Right.
And, you know, just really has good intention.
Mm-hmm. Very, very true. I agree with that. And I agree with you, the fact that there's certain, for lack of a better term here, protocol, and I'm not at all justifying what he did. What I'm saying
is that the
culture, it you'd be very surprised, because when certain cultures, from the perspective of, you know, like man, woman kind of thing, it's for family appropriation. And so as such, it's sad, because then where is the love? Are we in this for the love, or are we in this for something else? And so I agree with that, because I'm not wired that way myself either. And so having said that, but when reading your book, what I understand also, I see a lot of these guys, even though they may come across as being arrogant, but in all actuality, from the flip side, from the guy's standpoint of view, I see a lot of insecurities in the guys, because it's like, I have to pull out my portfolio to impress you. I mean, there's a certain amount, you know, for things that you have to do to make sure that, I mean, the other person understand what you have to offer. But above and beyond that, I do see that. I see a lot of, even though these individuals may be very, very successful, but then beneath all that facade, you have a very insecure person. That's my take on the deal from this side of the equation, so to speak. Anyway, another one story that I really enjoy, I thought it was really funny, is this person is perfect for you by Annie Downey. I thought that was just a wonderful story. It's really funny, actually. I felt that it's a very funny story because of the way things happen and develop and unfold. Please tell us about that.
Sure. What was great about this story is Annie had just, I believe she'd gone through a disastrous breakup. I believe since she had children, I think she must have been, she was just really going through this awful divorce or breakup. And She had in passing said to her mother, in just, you know, in a moment of sheer frustration, you know, I'm so done with men. And I think her mother took her quite seriously for some reason. And eventually her mother said, you know, I've met this great person, and I think this person is fabulous, and I think you're just really going to like Chris. And, you know, Annie never thought to ask, say, is Chris a woman or a man or what? I think she just assumed it was a man. And anyway, so the two get together, and this woman gets out of the car because they're meeting in a restaurant, and I guess Annie's still in her car putting on some makeup or whatever, and she sees this woman get out of a Jeep or what have you, and she thinks, oh, my God, it's a woman scorned. You know, the person my mother wanted to fix me up with has a girlfriend or something, or this is the ex-girlfriend, and she wants to, you know, there's going to be a brawl or whatever, and she rolls down her window, and before she can say anything, this woman, Chris, says, are you Annie? And she's like, yes, I am. And she's like, oh, great, you know, your mother told me so much about you, and it clicks for her that her mother has fixed her up with another woman. And so, you know, and during the meal, you know, she's sort of talking herself into saying, really, could it be that bad? You know, I've had so many bad dates, and then, you know, and then she just was like, I can't do it. It's not how I saw my life. And so that was really funny and unexpected and charming in its own way.
Yeah, it is. It's, I mean, the mother obviously was trying to help out, and that's the least that she could do, I guess, in some ways from her perspective. But the whole thing that developed, and it was just beautiful. I thought it was a funny story. And of course, you did end the book with a happy ending. Mother
yes.
Knows Even When She Doesn't, and by Melissa Peterson. Please tell us about that story, because it's a beautiful story too.
Well, this was a really interesting story. This Melissa had been on a succession of dates, and she was frustrated, and I believe at the time she had been on one of the dating websites, you know, Match or something, and her mother was at someone's home playing cards, and she saw a picture of, you know, what looked like a very lovely man, and she asked the woman who that was, and she said her son, and the two got to talking and said, oh, I have a daughter, is he single? I think this is the type of man my daughter would like, and she said, yes, he is, and the mother brought the information home, and Melissa and this nice fellow got together, and it was just an awful date. He didn't like cheese. She loved cheese. I don't know if either were really at the time in the place of wanting to date or being serious. And they just felt like they had nothing to talk about, nothing in common, and they didn't get along, and I think she found him snotty, and I'm just not sure exactly what happened, but the date really did not work, and she came home, and she was just like, Mom, it didn't work. I didn't like him. He didn't like cheese. And, you know, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing leads to another, and a few years pass, and the mother is now on the internet as the daughter. And because the mother is still insistent on finding her date. And she comes across this fellow's photo on the internet, and she says, oh, my God, you won't believe who's moving back to this town. You had a date with him. What do you think? And she's like, you know, it wasn't a great date. I didn't really like him. You know, maybe, you know, it's a nice thing to do is just reach out and say hello. And so they got together as friends with nothing more in, you know, with that was not the goal. It was just to really sort of reacquaint themselves. And they joked about the first date and how awful it was and that both didn't like each other. And suddenly, you know, one thing led to another, and maybe she felt he grew up a bit in those couple of years, or maybe he felt she grew up a bit in the last couple of years. And anyway, so they started dating, and then they got married.
Yeah, it was a beautiful story. Go ahead. Yeah.
I was going to say, so I, you know, the title comes from, you know, Mom is right, maybe even when she isn't, is that it didn't work out the first go round, but it clearly worked out on the second date.
What I gather from that particular story is that they obviously had a wonderful conversation in terms of the mother-daughter relationship. I think they were both involved with the website, I guess, in some case. I mean, so obviously they were in communication. I mean, Mom didn't really go behind the daughter's back to do anything. But she was, as you mentioned, she was kind of in charge of the daughter's personal life, which was kind of exciting. And of course, as you had mentioned, mom has the intention of always finding the best person for her daughter. And I guess in this particular case, it happened very well. What kind of reactions did you get from the various moms when this book came out?
Everybody was very good. You know, they were all good sports. Ideally, what we found out is that a lot of the mothers didn't realize how bad the dates were until they read it in the book, which I think is funny and yet also shows maybe there's a lack of communication somewhere. I'm sure after a really annoying date, you know, the last thing you want to do is maybe relive it step by step with your mother.
Right,
she was
right.
The one who instigated it. But a lot of the mothers, I think, got a much different perspective once they saw it on paper.
I'm sure, because they are looking, they want the best for the daughter. Had they been there, they would have just said, well, let's leave. I'm sure.
Yeah,
so
some mothers probably say, stick it out. I don't know. I mean, some mothers can be really pushy.
Do you have any contributors having problems with any of the characters that they wrote about in the book? Has any of the individuals sort of recognized themselves in the book and, say, maybe gotten back with the contributors and had a few things to say about the whole thing?
No, everybody was really, really fair and kind, and I don't think anybody has been stalked, and there have been no lawsuits. So, you know, again, these are all true stories, so in one sense it's really difficult. And I think all the women were really good about either, if they needed to, changing the name.
Very interesting. Now, to date, how many of these women... out of 26, obviously, you have one that got married, and well, two of them are actually married based on the book, if I'm not mistaken.
I'm trying to think who the other person is who's married. I think there was only one person who was married at the end. That last story is the only one that's married.
Well, the other one got married in the sense that she found the person, her Mr. Right on her own. It's one of the... I can't remember who it is.
No, she hadn't found him at that point, but she just said that she wanted to be able to find him on her own. I think, actually, apropos of that, I think she has gotten married since the book came out, but her big goal was she wasn't going to let her mother fix her up anymore.
So how about the rest of the women?
To be honest, I've written two books since that book came out, and we don't have a support group, or we don't all keep up with each other, which is a bit of a shame, because they're all lovely, smart, talented women. I'm not sure who's gotten married and who hasn't. It would be lovely if we had some sort of hotline where if they did get married, they would just be like a little shout-out to all the contributors. But as far as I know, in keeping up with my friend Anita, she's gotten married to a man that she met on her own. I believe there's a group of them who have moved on and gotten married, or at least are dating significant others at the moment.
Right. What have you learned from writing that book?
You know, it really just goes to mothers have good intentions. Sometimes they're a little too forceful. And that, you know, we've all been in the same boat. It is comforting to know that as bad as you think your date is, there's somebody's date that's even worse. My friend Sarah, who wrote a story, you know, this guy was as bizarro as they came, took her to a Starbucks for a cup of coffee, which, you know, look, there's nothing wrong with deciding to go for a cup of coffee or a drink rather than a full course meal. That's totally understandable, but... for whatever reason, he happened to have chosen a Starbucks that's riddled with homeless people. It's sort of known for, like, the homeless Starbucks. And he took out his headshots, and he was an actor, and he asked her to give her, her opinion. And then he decided to do a monologue, and he jumped up on the table at Starbucks in front of all the homeless people, who were happy because they got some entertainment, and proceeded to do a monologue out of Brighton Beach Memoirs. So, you know, that's really not what you expect out of your date. That's also a little bit out of a bad movie. And, you know, when you hear a story like that, it's very comforting to say, you know, my guy was rude and obnoxious, but at least he didn't jump on the table and do something out of Death of a Salesman and do it badly.
Right.
So there is that, yeah, your date was bad, but not as bad as mine. And I think there's something very comforting, and the stories are funny, and they're charming, and it was a wonderful project to work on, because, mm-hmm. you know, the book that I did after that was called Death Becomes Them, which really mm-hmm. could be a title for bad dates, because you just mm-hmm. want to kill half your dates, but it was Death Becomes Them, Unearthing the Suicides of the Brilliant, the Famous, and the Notorious, and it really dealt with, you know, 20 of the most influential and important suicides of our time, which was an extremely mm-hmm. serious and challenging book to work on. Mm-hmm. And prior to Have I Got a Guy for You coming out, I had written a novel called The Joy of Funerals. Mm-hmm. So really to sort of jump from something more serious to this lighter fare was mm-hmm. was a very enjoyable thing to be able to do. It was very commercial. It's a very commercial project for me. I'm not a chick-litty kind of girl. I don't.
Right.
I tend to focus on more on a bit darker fiction or a little more literary than just girl wants guy, girl loses guy, girl finds guy.
Mm-hmm.
I have this new novel that just came out called Based Upon Availability, and mm-hmm. You know, that was really nice to return to fiction, having been away from fiction for 7 years. So. Mm-hmm. You know, it's lovely as a writer to be able to jump around. And, you know, Have I Got a Guy for You does very well when I'm speaking at temples and sisterhoods and synagogues and communities and churches. And everybody can understand it. Again, it goes back to everybody has a mother and everybody's been on blind dates that are not great. So
right.
I think there's a lot of sympathy. And it was a group activity, you know, it wasn't just me working on a book by myself. I had 26 other women to work with and edit and to be part of something greater than myself, which was really lovely, and to be able to share this experience. And then in the same sense, it's really lovely to return to fiction and to go back to creating characters rather than working with something that's true to life.
Mm-hmm. Now, in writing Have I Got a Guy for You, obviously, I mean, everyone, even the men as well as women, have a sort of an idea of the ideal mate. Has that changed for you personally?
You know, sadly, it's not. I'm a very consistent person, and
uh-huh.
I think I'm really clear on, for me, uh-huh. on what I want, and
right.
Which may be good or bad. I mean, you know, you want kindness and humor and a best friend and a team player and someone who will be there at the good times and the bad times. And,
right.
you know, there is something wonderful about someone who's filled with dementia, who is not one of these cookie-cutter,
right.
Tissue-thin people. And that's what I look for. I don't think those goals have changed for me. I'm really not, I don't settle in my work. I wouldn't want to settle in something as important as my love life.
Mm-hmm.
So, to be honest, you know, it was never an experiment in finding out what I wanted as much as it was a chance to share these stories with other people and to sort
mm-hmm.
of have a kind of a group activity on paper. You know,
mm-hmm.
it feels like you're not, you know, for the single women who feel that they are less than because they're not with someone, or they feel that they've been made to feel that they're less than because there's no ring on their finger, or they're of the singleness out there, which there are thousands and thousands of single women and men.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this was more of one of those, you know, best friends you can put in your pocket and read and take humor in and nod and say, wow, that was great to hear, or I'm not alone, or that's funny. You know, what's nice is it works for both groups. It's great for the men to read because, you know, hopefully it'll give them a little bit of an idea of, you know, what they're doing wrong. And it's great for women to read because, you know, again, they can feel that they're not alone. And, you know, it was a great project to work on in terms of changing my idea from what I wanted or what I thought I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't. I think if those dates came, if you know, if we started all over and those dates came back, I think
mm-hmm.
I would. My guess is I would have the same issues. Well, one, you know, the married guy, I would need you not to be married.
Right.
But it wasn't just that. I mean, he was an arrogant, obnoxious, immature
mm-hmm.
boy, and I
right.
think you know that came across. He spit out the window
mm-hmm.
while we were driving. He had road rage.
Right.
He was a really bad pick.
Right.
You know, the biggest problem was, you know, my mother, again, it goes back to she doesn't ask questions. I think if my mother was a better investigator, if my mother, you know, asked questions like, you know, what does he do for a living?
Right.
Is he, you know, does he have a good sense of humor? How old is he? Does he have children? Is he married?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we
mm-hmm.
would have had a better place to go. In
mm-hmm.
the same sense, again, I have to give my mother, you know, a little leniency. She didn't know he was married, but that
mm-hmm.
came from not asking the right questions.
Right, right. Very interesting. Well, let's talk about your new book,
okay.
your second novel, Based Upon Availability. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Based Upon Availability is about eight women who pass through the doors of the Four Seasons Hotel here in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the hotel captures them at their finest and worst and most raw moments. And it really asks the question, what happens behind closed doors? And so part of the goal was to bring in a little bit of my travel writing experience and
mm-hmm.
my passion that I have for hotels, which I do. I adore hotels. It's a great love affair I have. But also to, you know, what I loved is that you get so many different perspectives within the novel. And all these women's lives are interconnected somehow, and I really wanted to make a statement about how, in some sense, our lives are interconnected, and, you know, the reasons we meet people we don't always understand, but they change our world. And so, and then I was fascinated with the concept of really what does happen behind closed doors, and what are we not privy to, and how do we, you know, how do we see a different side of the person? You know, we see one version of them, but, you know, behind the closed door, there's somebody else. We see a different side of them. So that's really what the goal was. I'm so proud of it. It was nice to return to fiction. It's so humbling. It's gotten great, great reviews, and
mm-hmm.
you know, It's really just it's lovely. It's lovely to have something be that accepted.
Does it give you a greater latitude in writing fiction, perhaps, and let your imagination, because you are very creative, and it sort of like flows much more freely versus, say, in a real life, real situation where you are sort of governed by certain perimeters in the way of, you know, what's there and what you see in real life situation.
You know, writing fiction and writing nonfiction are really different beasts.
Mm-hmm.
There is writing nonfiction in one sense, unless it's memoir, you know, a book like Death Becomes Them, very cut and dry in terms
right.
of, you know, all your information is there, how Hemingway shot himself, how Sylvia
mm-hmm.
put her head in the oven, how Virginia put stones in her pocket, how Freud, you know, OD'd on drugs. You know, it was all very cut and dry. The challenge for that was to find a way to creatively tell the stories and to have people feel as though they were there, which was, you know, one of my goals.
Mm-hmm.
So you're standing on this you're teetering on the abyss with Spalding Gray on the ferry. You know, you're in the river with Virginia when she's putting her rocks in her pocket.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
For fiction, totally different, because you don't have to answer to anyone. You create everything, and thank God there's no fact-checking. You know, that the fact-checking alone could drive you crazy. So it's wonderful to also have the ability to let your imagination just run wild and crazy, because it is so freeing. And you know, you're the manipulator of the story. You are... You know, I tell my students when I teach creative writing, you know, they're playing God, and if they can make it believable, fine, write it. That's their job.
Mm-hmm. Did you, by any chance, even though a lot of people that written fiction brought in some elements of real-life characters into their storyline, did any of these eight women or perhaps some supporting cast within your story that came from your experience, people that you encountered, and so forth?
I think as a good writer, you know, it definitely stems from something. Your fiction has to stem from parts of you or things that that you're about. And I think it's when my characters can come at something so differently than I would is where I'm on the right track for something. And I think that's a very big part of it. And I think, yeah, you bring in from your life, but you also, you also though can't make it all you. There has to be some sort of, the characters are going to do so many different things and act differently. So I think in one sense, yes, the idea or the things that I want to say as a writer are personal, our need for connection, our my personal obsession with human behavior and why people might act the way they do. I think that is a very me. Those are the things that interest me and the things that I'm about. And I think the passion of wanting to know that is how I sort of create these situations. And yes, some of it, of course, stems from a personal place. The Joy Funerals really had to do with this woman who goes to other people's funerals as a way to connect to other people because she's so lonely. For me, the personal aspect of that came from being an only child and not knowing a lot of family members and really only seeing my family when I went to a funeral. And, you know, you play the what-if game. What if I had a character who did that? What if, you know, I had somebody who was so unable to connect with people in her life that the only place she felt comfortable was at funerals? Now, I never went to a funeral I wasn't invited to. I've never, you know, crashed a funeral, but I have a character that does. And that's
right.
When fiction comes in, you play with the what-if game.
Right.
What if my character did this? What if that led her to that? What if?
Mm-hmm. No,
and that's really where it stems from. And my characters do weird, you know, crazy, very human things. I mean,
right.
Life is messy. Life is not pretty. Life is difficult. And I think we are all searching for something. My characters are driven, but they're needy and they're filled with desire, and they often, you know, don't get what they want.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, they're really out there. They're very honest, and they do very odd and yet beautiful and raw things.
In your latest book, based upon availability, do you have a little bit of you in each one of the eight women, or is it something that you just kind of identified it with one particular person, so to speak?
No, they're all vastly different, you know. And again, you know, I'm sure there's a little bit of me or the idea, you know. Really, not, you know, these characters for this novel is. Not really. I mean, some of it certainly stems from people I know, where they're a mix of, you know, I have an aging rock star who goes to dry out. She's sent to the hotel by her publicist. Is really, you know, a sort of, they're two celebrity rock stars that I sort of melded into one.
Mm-hmm.
I have, you know, there's another woman whose sister is so mean to her, and all this, you know, all this character wants is to have a good relationship with her sibling. And, you know, that's certainly some of that idea or some of the characteristics came from, you know, other situations that I know and people that I've dealt with. But, you know, those people have never ended up in the hotel. They've never, you know, it stems from an idea, but then you have to create a whole world around it. So it's not the easiest question. It's not the easiest, you know, question to answer, because you're really creating, you're creating so much of it.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point you have to let your characters go. And as soon as my characters start doing things I know I personally would never do, like handcuff somebody to a bed or, you know, sleep with your married therapist, you know, those characters are often running. But the ideas come from, you know, again, the what if. What if I had a character who wanted X, Y, and Z? What if I had, you know, what if she met this guy accidentally? What if he ended up being the uncle to somebody else who works in the hotel? And you really, it's really just created. That's the beauty of in one sense, fiction.
Right. Well, tell us how can someone buy your books and keep up with your latest happenings?
Well, you can buy the books, thank God, anywhere. If you want to buy it on the web, you know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Borders, you know, those are all great places to go. There are also some independent book chains that I know people enjoy frequenting. You can also follow me on my website, which is alixstrauss.com. And Alix is spelled with an I, so it's A-L-I-X-S-T-R-A-U-S-S. And, you know, I do a Facebook thing every day. I tweet. I do all sorts of updates. And right now we're doing a lot of reaching out to hotels. So I've been reading in a variety of hotels, be it Trump Soho here in New York. I also read at Fashion 26, which was great. I'm doing a four-part reading series at a hotel called Inc. 48. And that's a phenomenal hotel on 11th Avenue and 48th Street, and that was an old printing press. And so what's really great is their philosophy is make your mark. And it's all about ink, and the rooms are, or the main rooms that they have in the hotel are named after fonts. So it's, you know, and then I'm reading in Boston at a hotel called The Liberty, which is so lovely. That used to be an old jail turned into a high-end hotel. So part of the venues for me, the big thing is to take this idea of, you know, all the characters being in a hotel and being able to read at other hotels in terms of having a venue match the theme of a novel. So that's really been something that I've been working very hard at. And all the hotels have been so receptive and so lovely. So it's been really terrific.
That's wonderful. Touch a little bit about, you got a couple of books that you've written in the past that has the movie options on them. Just tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. The Death Book has been optioned by a TV producer, and so we're just starting to reach out now to, I guess, TV programming, and, you know, whether it's A&E or MTV or VH1 or CBS. I mean, hopefully it'll be some sort of real-life docu-series. The Joy Funerals was an option for a little while, and that that option actually just ran out, so that's up for grabs. And based upon availability, which we're really excited about, Liz Smith was so kind and gave it such a rave review and just said that she saw this as such a the next big movie, which is lovely. And she, you know, what's nice is there are, you know, eight solid women in it, and she sort of compared it to MGM's old days of Grand Hotel. I actually have a meeting later on today with my agents just to talk about, you know, where we're going to send that out. And Have I Got a Guy for You was also recently, I think that option actually just ran out too. And so that, you know, we're reconsidering what to do with that. So it's a, you know, it's a process. I think it's very difficult to get films and projects made, and it's a very difficult time in the industry.
But you have accomplished so much, though, because I think these are the things that I would consider public, in the sense that it's the masses, and of course you have written for a number of years and everything else. So looking back in your life, if you could just share some turning points, you know, we have little shifts within our lives that sort of propel us to the next step, to the next step. So if you have an opportunity to kind of go back here, say, anywhere between 5, 10, 15, 20 years, what are those little shifts that have happened in your life, throughout your life for the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years that sort of got you to the point where you're at today?
I think having, you know, Joy of Funeral, I think a big point was I had written a nonfiction piece for the live section of the New York Times called The Joy of Funerals, and it did talk about my being an only child and why I enjoyed going to funerals. And I think rather than shifts, they're golden moments almost. And that was such a, you know, it was my first piece for The Times. And since then, you know, I've contributed quite frequently to The Times, which, you know, was one of my goals. And that's been really incredible to achieve. So that was a major moment. Certainly getting The Joy of Funerals published was a major moment. we had the book party at a funeral home, major moment, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say that there are turning points where one says I became a better writer, or they're more like accomplishments. Being able to you know, each reading in its own right is a little accomplishment. To be able to have these hotels be so welcoming and to, you know, jump on board to an idea that I had,
mm-hmm.
is really lovely and charming and exhilarating.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're taking a bit of a risk, and at the same time, you know, I'm changing the way we view readings and, in some sense, you know, entertainment. There
mm-hmm.
are different, you know, there's not everybody has plans when they go to a hotel. Not everybody has, you know, not everybody wants to sit in the bar either. You know, people are lonely and they might be traveling for business and very often are looking for something to do. And New York is a little bit different because there's always something happening and we can really walk
mm-hmm.
on foot and, you know, walk across the street and we're right in the action. But, you know, there isn't always that opportunity. And so to be in Detroit or San Francisco or wherever it is and to not know anybody and to be idling, you know, wasting away your time within that hotel room itself, but to know that a reading's going on and have something to do is a very different way of looking at what a hotel is all about. And so I think hotels, as they start to reach out and look for different ways to acknowledge and to thank their guests, you know, they're more open to finding additional venues for entertainment and things like that. And it's really great to sort of be able to do a book tour
mm-hmm.
in a decade where publishers, unfortunately, aren't always, you know, it's not where they put the money. It's not,
right.
You know, they're not big fans of touring. They just, you know, which is unfortunate. That 26-city tour doesn't exist anymore. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's such an accomplishment, and it takes so long to get a book published to just do one reading, you know, isn't enough for me. And I'm really, I guess in my own way, I'm trying to bring back the book tour. And it's been really great to have such positive response from other venues that you wouldn't necessarily think are going to be the people opening up their doors to you. And so, you know, the novel's been successful thus far,
mm-hmm.
and the way in which we're approaching the readings and how to sort of do outreach has been successful. And it's been a wonderful ride. It's a wonder, you know, and it's such a tangible piece of, you know, a book is forever. I could
mm-hmm.
drop dead tomorrow, you know, I could fall out my, you know, out my window, and that
mm-hmm.
book is still there. That book,
right.
you know, and I get letters from people, which is amazing to me, that someone who doesn't know me, who read my novel, took the time to reach out and say, I really enjoyed this, or this kind of changed my view on this, or I
right.
really felt connected, is amazing. That's amazing.
Right.
So it's been a fabulous journey.
What can we expect for you for the rest of the year? Obviously, you're on this little tour. Any books in the horizon?
Yeah, I'm working on my next novel. Just started to work on my next novel now, and I really have a full tour, luckily, for the next several months. So that's been really fantastic, and what a lot of my effort has been put into.
Fantastic.
Other than that, I think that's pretty much it. Maybe I'll go on some bad dates and have fodder for my next book.
There you go. We're coming to the end of the show. Do you have a recipe for living you would like to share with our listeners this morning?
You know, I think part of it is you really have to want something and do
mm-hmm.
it. So often, you know, there are people who say, oh, I wish I could do this or I wish I could do that. It's just, you know, you've really got to put yourself out there to try and do it. I think life really will pass you by unless you're a player, unless you're part of it.
I understand that. Well, thank you very much. And to all our listeners, thank you for being with us this morning. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be Abby Dees. She's a civil rights attorney and an author. Please join Abby and I as we will be discussing a public service book. It's called Queer Questions, Straight Talk, that will help you to break the ice about a very difficult question on how to talk to your friends who are gay, lesbians, as well as bi loved ones. And perhaps this book will help you find an opportunity to be able to communicate more effectively. For additional information about this show, future shows, and my recipes for living, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. Alex, thank you so much for being with us this morning, and good luck with your new book, and all the best to you. To our listeners, have a great day.
Thank you so much.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.